As many of you know, we hold independent policy forums on a regular basis, and this evening's program is one that we're quite excited about. For those of you new to the Institute, hopefully you've all gotten a copy of the packet of information about our program. Those of you who are new to our program, the Independent Institute is a nonprofit scholarly public policy research institute. We produce many books. We have a quarterly journal. In case you haven't put your eye on this one, this is particularly nice because it has a review by Jeff Hummel, an article by Jeff Hummel on the current issue. And we conduct many conference and media projects based on our studies. The upcoming events that we're going to be holding, our next event is going to be on January 19th. The title is Freedom and the Closing of the 20th Century and the New Millennium. The speaker will be Robert Conquest, who is an eminent historian, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He's the author of the new book, Reflections on a Ravaged Century. Some of you may be familiar with his books, most notably The Great Terror, Harvest of Sorrow, and Stalin, Breaker of Nations. In February, the exact date is yet to be determined, but we will be holding a program entitled Global Warming, Fact or Fiction. The speaker will be Dr. S. Fred Singer, who is an author of a book that we publish called Hot Talk, Cold Science. And Dr. Singer is the author of many books. He's also president of the Science and Environmental Policy Project. He's the founding director, was the founding director of the U.S. Weather Satellite Service, former director of the Center for Atmospheric and Space Physics, former chief scientist for the U.S. Department of Transportation, and on and on. So I hope that you all be able to join with us for these and future events. For this evening, we are indeed delighted to have two of the most exciting authors and scholars in American history. They will be drawing on their acclaimed books. Historians Henry Mayer and Jeffrey Rogers Hummel will be examining the Civil War as perhaps the great turning point in American history. Some even think it's a greater turning point than the American Revolution. I wouldn't go that far, but it's certainly a major turning point since the Revolution. And those of you who have seen, who have not seen their books, we hope that you'll get a copy. This is Jeff's book, which is called Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men. It's available, as you can see, in soft cover. Incidentally, you can't buy this book any other place except here. This, we're the only people who apparently have copies in the world right now. It will be reprinted, but we don't know when. And the other book, of course, is Henry Mayer's fantastic book, All on Fire, William Lloyd Garrison and the Abolition of Slavery, for which he was National Book Award finalist. And we hope that you will get copies of each. In the course of the Civil War, the evil of slavery was abolished, yet the war established federal power over states, expanded federal power over individuals, essentially, and paradoxically may have created precedents that restrict individual freedom today. So that's part of the ongoing dispute or debate about the Civil War. The ideas and personalities of the Civil War are etched in American history. The Civil War is a topic for which there are probably more books written and published than any other subject in American history. Those of you who are Civil War buffs know the enormous extent of organizations and interest in all aspects of the Civil War. How the abolitionists, the contending political and business interests, the mobilization that led to the war, the conduct of the war, and much more shaped American society at that time and since will be part of our discussion tonight. The plan is that Henry Mayer will be the first speaker, and Jeff Hummel will speak afterward, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So our first speaker is Henry Mayer. Henry graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and earned his MA in history at the University of California, Berkeley. As I mentioned, he's a finalist for the 1998 National Book Award for his book, All on Fire. He's also won the J. Anthony Lucas Book Prize, the Boston Book Review's Rhea Prize for Nonfiction, the Commonwealth Club of California's Silver Medal for Nonfiction, and the New York Times Book Review Notable Book of 1998 for All on Fire. He's also the author of the book, A Son of Thunder, Patrick Henry and the American Republic, which is in a new edition, right?
It's in paperback, and there may be another new edition.
Really a fantastic, if you haven't read this book, it's one of the most exciting books, I think, on the American Revolution. His reviews have appeared in the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and many other places. It's a real pleasure to introduce Henry Mayer.
Well, thank you, David. I'm very glad to be here and to share the platform with Jeff Hummel, who has written indeed a most stimulating and interesting book, and we will get into some of the issues that he raises later on. The organizer is playing with fate here because he's asked me to start by giving you a sort of half-hour version of a talk I usually take nearly an hour to give, and I usually have slides and all this stuff. So I'm going to rush through some things, and then what I don't say we'll leave for questions and the discussion period. The first thing I need to say is it's not always been apparent as I've gone around this year to people that Garrison's story is part of the Civil War story. That's really point number one. If you watched Ken Burns' epic at the beginning of this decade, and I guess all of us did, Garrison goes by in a blink. 30 seconds, no more. I haven't gone back to time it, but he's not a great presence. And I think what we're talking about with Garrison is a generation's worth of work before we come to the period that we identify as the Civil War, because Garrison broke the silence on an issue that had been successfully, at the time, compromised at Philadelphia. So successfully compromised that it really didn't figure very much in the debate over ratification, which is the principal focus or the dramatic focus of my book on Patrick Henry. And it was the unfinished nature of the discussion over slavery in the Constitution that really led me to Garrison in the first place, because for reasons I'll explain later, if you ask me, I had a continuing interest in this issue of slavery and civil rights. So I went in search of Garrison, and I went in search first of a person who I understood from the blips in my history books as a crusading editor. And he was the editor who, and in lieu of slides, I can't do this without visual aids. These are the glossies from which the pictures in the book were made that I then converted into slides to trot around to show audiences. So you're getting, I guess, the grandfather here. And I have an original Liberator to show you in a little while. This is page one of the first Liberator. It came out in 1831, January 1st, 1831. When I called the Boston Public Library at the outset of this project, because I said, well, I've seen the Liberator on microfilm and pictures, but I'd really like to hold some in my hand. Are there any still around? And she said, oh, well, yeah, we have Garrison's. And I had this sort of, yeah, right, I had sort of goosebumps. But Garrison was a printer, and printers save their work. And he had a complete file of the Liberator from day one to issue 1803. And he donated them, or his sons donated them, to the Boston Public Library. I'll come back and tell you a little bit about more Legrade in a minute. But this is who I went to find, was this sort of crusading editor. And what he says in the first issue, and Jeff, if you'll pass me my glasses, I said when I started my book, I didn't need to have glasses, but this was a crucial period in my life. He said, I am aware that many object to the severity of my language, but is there not cause for severity? I will be as harsh as truth, as uncompromising as justice. On this subject, I do not wish to think, speak, or write with moderation. No, no. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of the ravisher. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which it has fallen. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard. This was his journalistic credo. He was the most independent of editors. And I was interested in finding out sort of where the power came from to sustain this kind of work. But in searching for a journalistic crusader, I found a religious visionary. And I want to tell you a little bit about that and then go back and sketch in his life. The Liberator was at the beginning when I called the library. The very last day I was working on the photos, the last bit of research for this big, big project, I was in the Massachusetts Historical Society. And I had called up a bunch of things, and with photo research, particularly on the last day, you go in pretty fast. And I had a plane to catch. I was coming back to California, and I was tidying up my papers, and the librarian said I had, there was one more item I had called up, and it was an oversized broadside, and the card in the catalog said broadside Worcester 185 ? And I don't know why I called it up, but I called everything else that had abolition or anti-slavery on it. So I said, oh, gee, all right. Well, I went over, and because it was on a separate table because it was so big, and it was this huge broadside. This is a slight reduction of it. And when I looked at it carefully, I realized that Worcester wasn't really the place. I mean, Worcester was the place where the printer was. But this occasion is a 4th of July picnic like no other in American history. And this is the only physical remnant we have of it. It's from 1854. I dated it because the railroad excursion rates in here, it's the only year the rates were that way. They went up every year, and they were lower the year before. So what was this picnic? Well, this was a gathering of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. They had the picnics every year. This was right after Anthony Burns had been sent back to slavery from Boston. After a week of protest, after President Fillmore had sent the, President Pierce had sent the Marines and a revenue cutter to supplement the soldiers already on duty in Boston to take this one guy back into slavery. And it was the turning point in Boston in terms of making abolition and anti-slavery respectable. Now this, if you calculate, it's 25 years after Garrison started the Liberator. This has been a long journey. So this 4th of July was conceived as not a celebration, but as a period of mourning. Sojourner Truth was there, Abby Kelly was there, Wendell Phillips was there. All the big abolition names were there. Henry David Thoreau, no relation, I think. No relation. Came over from Concord. He was not on the speaker's list, but he'd written something out, and they let him say it, of course. And Garrison found his talk so spirited that he asked for a copy, and he had it in the Liberator as a text within a couple of weeks. Thoreau's talk was called Slavery in Massachusetts, and it was talking about the implication of Massachusetts citizens and the guilt of having returned this fugitive slave. But Thoreau's talk was overshadowed by what Garrison did next. Garrison talked, and he usually was very optimistic, very visionary, But today, that day, he was quite mournful about the prospects for liberty. And he spoke at some length, and then he trumped himself by what he did. He held up a batch of papers, and he lit them afire. They were the orders, copies of the orders returning Burns to slavery, and a copy of the Fugitive Slave Act itself. And he burned it and cried out with this great revivalist injunction, let all the people say amen. And the picnic goers all called out amen. And then he burned the commissioner's orders, sending Burns back. People cried out amen again. And then he held up the Constitution in the United States, lit it, and watched it burn, and cried out, let the people say amen, and everybody cried amen, although there were a few hisses, the reports go. This was really the pinnacle of Garrison's career in agitation. And some of you may realize this, I hadn't realized this, but he was deliberately emulating Martin Luther's burning of the papal law that had excommunicated him for heresy. And he was acting out a ritual of iconoclasm that was really unprecedented in American history, and was calling people to a higher standard of citizenship, a sort of moral witness for a citizenship that went beyond the confines of the law. Thoreau's talk had distilled a dozen years of this kind of Garrisonian agitation into an aphorism. Thoreau was wonderful at that. The law cannot make men free, men have to make the law free. And this was pure Garrisonism. At Framingham in 1854, Garrison engaged in this symbolic expression of it that was really both inspiring and frightening. It got him a lot of attention, pro and con, but it summarized a decade's worth of his thinking. Now, let me back up and quickly sketch his history and then come to what I think are his achievements. He was born in Newburyport in 1805. His father was a sailor who had been put out of work by the Jefferson embargo, pretty much, had turned to drink, and abandoned the family when he was 3 or 4 years old. His mother was a nurse, kind of nurse that went and lived in other people's homes to care for a newborn child and the just-delivered mother. And she had to leave her own children with other people while she did that. And she was a Baptist. Now, we all think of New England as all these big white congregational churches and a certain kind of orthodoxy. New England in the early 19th century was alive with various kinds of dissenting sects and religions, of which the Baptists were relatively well-established bunch. Garrison's mother was a Baptist, although her occupation was was nursing. Her calling was preaching. And she was a lay preacher who spoke in church, who founded women's prayer meetings in most of the towns she lived in. And Garrison was raised in this collective way by a church community steeped in piety. And that's where a lot of this energy comes from. So he apprentices to a printer. He has a few years of regular schooling, nothing approaching high school education. He's self-taught. He reads at night. He reads the great epics, Pilgrim's Progress, Paradise Lost. He reads Shakespeare, he reads the Columbian Orator for the political side, and he reads the modern romantic poets, Wordsworth and Shelley and Byron. And somehow he absorbed a lot of Byron's titanic yearning for a reformed world and a willingness to confront established icons, and that sense of being an outlaw engaged in a righteous cause. He absorbed all that without succumbing to Byron's impiety, which was what all the elders feared was going to happen for all these young people who are reading Byron. And he forges out of these strands, a sort of evangelical piety and a certain political and romantic idealism, an identity as a reformer, what people of his time called a philanthropist, which now we've reduced to giving away money. But if you look at the roots of the words, we're talking about love of humanity. Philo and Anthro. He's called particularly, he was interested in a number of reforms, temperance, Sunday school, that kind of thing, but nothing particularly caught for him until he met a Quaker itinerant named Benjamin Lundy, who was going around the upper tier of southern states and into New England, agitating against slavery and urging the formation of anti-slavery societies, particularly within the Quaker meetings, but also more generally. And he didn't get very far in Boston, but he did convert Garrison. And ultimately, Garrison went to work for Lundy, running a newspaper in Baltimore called The Genius of Universal Emancipation. And when they antagonized the Baltimore powers that be, largely Jacksonian Democrats, by, you know, aggressive attacks on slave trading in Baltimore, the paper, Garrison was charged with criminal libel, and the paper was shut down. Criminal libel was hadn't been used in Maryland since the Revolution, really. And it was a real judicial repression. And Garrison couldn't pay the fine, actually didn't want to pay the fine, went to jail, which of course deepened his convictions. And when he got out of jail, he was propelled into the founding of the Liberator. The Liberator was sustained in the beginning by small communities of free black people in Boston and a few reformers among the religious elite in Boston. But it was definitely an outcast kind of thing. And for perspective, what I want to remind you of is that in 1831, when Garrison did this, number one, he was 25 years old. The other people of his age cohort, we won't hear from for a generation. Lincoln was still splitting rails in Illinois. Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee had just graduated from West Point and were on Army duty. Stephen A. Douglas was reading law in New York. Frederick Douglass was learning to read as a slave in urban Baltimore. Harriet Beecher Stowe was teaching composition in her sister's female seminary. And all their lives and everybody else's a generation further on were going to be changed by what Garrison had set in motion. The other thing of perspective to remember is this. When Garrison started the Liberator, in 1831, the President of the United States was Andrew Jackson. He was a slaveholder. Every president, with the exception of the two Adamses from Massachusetts, had been slaveholders. Every member of the bench, every clergyman, all the prominent political leaders, all agreed that slavery was an institution peculiar to the South. We use peculiar institution in the sense of a sort of disgust about this is something set to one side or unique. That's our interpretation of the word. In the 19th century, when they said peculiar, they meant local. And the idea was slavery was an institution peculiar to the jurisdictions that had it and was not on the agenda, was not within the jurisdiction of the U.S. Constitution, executive, legislature, judiciary. Almost every political candidate believed that the only way slaves could be freed would be if they were to be voluntarily repatriated to Africa. There was no sense, and that stems from Jefferson on down, Henry Clay, all the major leaders, the clergy, considered colonization a liberal reform solution to the problem of slavery. There was no possibility in their sort of political cosmos for envisioning black people as citizens. What Garrison says in that first Liberator, and what he continues to say throughout his career, is that abolition has to be accompanied by equal rights. And when Garrison is described as a fanatic, and when the severity of his language is disparaged, it's not the style. The journalistic style of the period was very swashbuckling. They called it slang-wanging, and it was rough. It was as much rough. I mean, it was really a lot worse than today. And it wasn't Garrison's style that was the problem. It was the substance of the issues he aimed it at. He incurred a tremendous amount of abuse. He was nearly lynched in Boston. Abolitionists in general encountered mob violence through most of the 1830s. And it was largely on the issue, first, of breaking the silence and forcing slavery, trying to force slavery onto the agenda. And it really took from 1831 to the mid-1840s to get slavery onto the agenda. First, nobody wanted to talk about it, and from 1846 on, no one could talk about anything else. And it was the kind of racist abuse that I have some cartoons which are in the book. I won't stop to show you except for one in a few minutes. But it was really awful, and that's what got Garrison into trouble. It was the fusion of abolition and equality, a complete moral argument. The second area that got him into trouble, of course, was his attack on the Constitution. And I think the implications of that attack I'll leave to the discussion, but I want to gloss one cartoon for you because this is the only representation. Am I doing this? Okay. This is the only representation that I've ever seen of the Three-Fifths Clause. Now, you all remember that the Three-Fifths Clause gave extra power to the slaveholding states on the basis of their slave population. It has nothing to do with slaves voting. Sometimes people sort of say it in a way that makes it seem. It has to do with 60% more votes in Congress and in the Electoral College because you're counting the black, 60% of the black population, three-fifths, as well as the white population. And when we think of the Civil War, the image that comes to mind, the visual image that comes to mind, or the controversy, not the war itself, is the map with the Missouri Compromise line, and then it extends out to the Pacific, and then you have Kansas and Nebraska, and what happened with the Mexican territories, all these kind of territorial solutions. For the abolitionists, the territorial issue was the tip of the iceberg. What they were interested in was the question of uprooting slavery from the states. And constitutionally, their hands were tied because pretty much the Constitution, the sort of implicit word of the Constitution and the existence of the Three-Fifths Clause and the existence of the Fugitive Slave Law committed the Constitution to the protection of slavery and slaveholders' property rights. This is an abolitionist version of that, in which the interesting thing to me, when we have those westward movement pictures, we have liberty moving westward, and liberty in America are depicted always as one. Here, liberty and America are separate creatures, and neither one is doing very well. If you can see, and I guess I can't, this, you see, is America. Her plume is drooping. She's weak. She's hiding behind her power is the slave representation clause. That's what this is, the only visual representation I've ever seen. She has this slave, this person enslaved. Over here is liberty, and she looks even worse than America. She's really drooping. And in the center is philanthropy. Remember, that's the reformers' name for themselves. Philanthropy is appealing to America to release the slave and revive liberty. Philanthropy is holding the scroll, and on it says all men are created equal. And essentially what this is doing is the abolitionists are critiquing the Constitution from the standpoint of the Declaration of Independence. Their argument is the only way to morally, purge or fumigate, cleanse, that's a more positive word, cleanse the Constitution is to liberate slaves, get rid of the shield, the phony shield of the Three-Fifths Clause, strengthen America by doing that, and revive liberty. And this is a very different vision of the whole Civil War controversy than you usually hear, because it's the abolitionist extremist vision that has not made its way in full dress into the textbook sort of count of the middle ground. So Garrison persisted. Garrison had this paper, and I want to say a word about the paper and then move on to what happens when we get to the war. Garrison always thought that moral suasion, building a public opinion on the basis of people coming to an understanding of the moral issues involved, would ultimately lay the groundwork for a political movement. He was not interested in a sort of premature version of electoral politics, because he thought with the South's thumb on the scales, you see, there was no possibility of constitutional amendments. And without constitutional amendments, anyone who came into office, no matter how well-intentioned, would be bound by the constitutional compromises to enforce the fugitive slave law. If they didn't, then maybe there'd be trouble, and so on. What I want to show you is how he did it in terms of creating a public opinion. Sort of week in and week out, he published this paper. The first Liberator, the one I showed you, was about this size. And gradually, the pages got bigger until I think this page is even bigger than what our morning paper is today. And this is, I'm going to move over here. This came out every week. And as you see, it doesn't really look very much like our modern newspaper. No big headlines. Oh, no big headlines. You know, would you hold this for me then? I can't. Thank you. No big headlines, no little takeout boxes of quotes, nothing. Now, if you think this is a lot to read, let's open it up. You take one corner and I'll take the other. And then there's still more. So it would certainly take you a week to read it. And you know how it was printed. He set the outside pages and then printed them, hung them up to dry, and then went. So the inside pages actually have the more current news. I'll leave this out and you all can look at it later. But this is real rag paper, hard metal type, set by hand, often composed without paper, just for memory. And he did this week in and week out. He didn't do it all by himself. He hired people. When he traveled, he had friends who would sit in the editorial chair for him. Now, he didn't write it all himself. What this is one column that is filled with the worst kind of racist, oppressive language, just to show people what they were up against. Then there's a lot of stuff out of the Congressional Record. There are proclamations. There are sort of official things that show implications of the slave system. Then inside their editorials, whenever there's an anti-slavery meeting, he then prints the text of the speeches. When some enlightened politician comes around to a halfway support for something or other, he prints some of that. He conducts a lot of quarrels with other editors. He will clip an editorial, reprint it from another paper, and he will stud that editorial with little typographical marks, asterisks, daggers, so on and so on, and all his footnotes will be at the bottom. And then that editor, so critiqued, will reprint Garrison's critique, answer it, and it's sort of like internet cut and pasting, except it's done the hard way. Real cut and paste, well, real set type print cut paste, and so on. Now, I have seen in the library these fan-like piles of very neatly clipped stuff from other papers that Garrison was home at night or sometimes all day with this stuff, sorting out, finding the best things to select, because each week was a little anthology. There were his editorials, there were then letters, the debates in the Liberator went on and on and on, sometimes internal, interim movement arguments. One question, and I'll come back to it later if you want, is should, when the British people raised money for Frederick Douglass to buy his freedom, was that an ethical thing to do or not? And let's leave the answer for a little while. Anyway, if you just think of the tenacity and the persistence, this is not simply a crusading editor. This is somebody with a vision of a different kind of society. And this is not only Garrison. This is a lot of folks writing in here, black and white. And what somebody said when the Liberator finally closed, Liberator closed in December 1865, and it was able to have in its next to last issue the text of the just ratified 13th Amendment that officially abolished slavery, purged it from the Constitution. So it was a very poetic ending for the Liberator, and people were kind of awed by it. By that time, of course, a lot had changed. Anyway, somebody said it was not a one-man stand. It was a perpetual Quaker meeting for 1,803 issues. It's really quite astonishing. The only artwork was this little drawing of a slave auction, and then he added, in subsequent years, he added a comparative vision of freedom, free labor. And then in the 1850s, he joined those two visions, contrasting panels, with a circular medallion that was a figure of Jesus Christ and the Golden Rule. Garrison had two bases for his agitation, the Golden Rule and the Declaration of Independence. And what happened, in a way, is they crashed in on each other, the two pillars, because he always envisioned a moral transformation that would ultimately occur through politics. And as you know, and as Jeff is going to probably talk about in more detail, and we'll get in the question period, the political system broke down over these issues. Once Garrison got it on the agenda, the political system could not cope with it. And when Garrison talked about a second Reformation or a second American Revolution, he meant it, I think, in metaphorical terms. We heard it, the American culture heard it, in physical terms. Our revolution was a physical revolution. And so Garrison was a pacifist, a non-resistant. He really was a practitioner of what Gandhi and King later would understand as soul force. That's really what the Liberator is about, is soul force. And essentially, he was both heard and misheard, because people, when finally persuaded of the immorality of slavery and the need to purge it from the Constitution, couldn't do it through soul force. It only happened through military means and through this dreadful war that cost 600,000 deaths and severely tested Garrison, because he had to surrender his pacifism in order to support, to help get the war to the point where it was not simply a war for union, but was a war for abolition. Abolition was not an original aim of the war. And I know we're going to talk about this later, so I'll just get it out on the agenda now. But look, for 1 minute, this is Garrison, the youthful Garrison you've seen on the cover of my book. This is Garrison in 1865, after the war. In which the toll has really taken. He really aged tremendously in those few years. And this is a caricature of Garrison. In the same month that Lincoln was getting ready to sign the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, this is what a Vanity Fair, a Democratic newspaper that aspired to be like Punch, had a lot of caricatures in it. This is Garrison smoking some kind of bad, dark tobacco and a fetish pipe that is releasing all these savage creatures into the air. This is not really very subtle, but the dreamy idealist that's going to cause us all a big problem by this stuff he's letting loose. And this is the climate in which abolition had to make its way. From the same newspaper, just to end on a constitutional note, this is an attempt to argue that slavery had nothing to do, slavery has nothing to do with the war. It's called Sambo Agonistes, and it's having the slave pushing on the pillars of the constitutional temple, and it says, but they don't fall. Well, they did. And one of our problems, and I'll end on this, is that we have never really understood the Civil War as a tragedy of race. We've understood it as a tragedy of flag. And that's to a certain degree obscured what really caused it. And because we backed into abolition, and Garrison came to recognize this, because we backed into abolition, in a way it didn't last. And that's both his tragedy, and I think it's ours.